Right. I think this is working.
Ah, good seats are available if you act now. Even some cups. All right, we'd like to welcome everyone to the third installment of the Believe It or Not lecture series. Poop, poop, poop. So this week's topic is the topic of Ayin Hara, literally the evil eye. So of the topics discussed, the one that has the strongest background in terms of actual material on it is the topic of Ayin Hara. There's a surprisingly lot to be said about it. The Chumash itself, if you remember, we read not long ago Parsha Shkolim. There came a time when the Jews got into the desert and there had to be a census. So instead of doing the traditional one potato, two potato, God told them that they each have to give a half a shekel. And then they counted how many shekels they got, multiplied it by two, ta-da, there are the people. And the Chumash itself says, why do you do it that way? Why not doing a regular, normal count? So it says, in order to show ye negev, to avoid the plague. What plague? Where? Who was talking plague? So the plague is that the Rashi tells us that there's something called an ayin hara. If you count something, if you look at something too closely, that can lead to an ayin hara, could be dangerous. And therefore, to avoid that, we do this in an indirect way. And in fact, practically, a lot of times, you'll still do things like that when you're counting for a minion. And we don't count one, two, three, but rather we'll say a pasuk, we'll use some other way of trying to do it rather than counting the person. In fact, there's a lot of discussion in Israel. Israel is a country like any other country, so they want to take a census. You need to know who lives where should we be putting our money. And the problem is that many people in Israel tend to be Orthodox Jews who don't want to participate in it. It becomes very difficult. If people are going to refuse to be counted, it's going to be very hard to get an accurate count. So every 10 years this comes up, and every 10 years there's negotiations between the various rabbinic authorities and the government, and they come up with a way of indirectly counting the people yet getting somewhat accurate numbers also. So this is a discussion that there's something called Ayin Hara. In fact, in Pirkei Avos, we learn at the beginning of the second parak that one should avoid, in order, what kills a person? Yetzer Hara and Ayin Hara, right? The evil inclination and the evil eye. That a person, and again, Rabbeinu Yonah says that what is the evil eye? The evil eye is I see something that you have, I become jealous of it, I look at it at you in a certain way, I look askance, and that's a good word. And with that, we have a, that in fact can be damaging to a person. In fact, how damaging could it be? So the Gemara in Bava Metzia tells us that Rav one time went to a cemetery and he did a test. And based on his test, he determined that 99 out of 100 people died from Ayin Hara. That was the test. He explained, he cut it to the tree or something. It's interesting, as we consider the new Obama Medical Act, he should consider, if you just wipe out Ayin Hara, that would take care of 99% of the problem. So you have this thing called Ayin Hara, which we seem to be taking very seriously. Repeatedly, there is this discussion about the Ayin Hara. In fact, there is a discussion in the Gemara in Erevin. Talks about a case of somebody wins the lottery. Right? They didn't really have lotteries in those days, but what they had was called the Nichsei Hager. Everybody has a relative. We read in last week's Torah reading that when a person passes on, the property goes to the next of kin. If there is a son, it goes to the son. If not sons, daughters. If not no children, then it goes up to the father. The father has passed on, it goes to the brothers if there are any. The father's passed on and there's no brothers, it goes to the grandfather, the uncles, the cousins. There's a way that we figure out everything. What if you have somebody who at the end of the day has absolutely no relatives whatsoever? How could it be? No relatives whatsoever? A 93rd cousin, something there's got to be. So there's one case of a person who has no relatives. And that person is a convert. A convert is not related to anybody according to halacha. Not related to this non-Jewish biological family. We know the concept is a gershin is gaya kikatan shenolatami. If someone converts as if they were reborn, so So in terms of that, there's no relations technically as far as the legalistic halacha goes. And if they never get married and if they don't have children, they have no relatives. So what happens to this person's property if they should die intestate? So what's the answer? The answer is, it's hefker. Whoever gets first come, first serve. So get to know. No, I wouldn't say this is a business model that a person would want to follow. Not that it wouldn't work, but in the rare case, if you have someone who converts that did not leave a will, etc., first come, first serve. It doesn't go to the state; it goes to whoever gets it. So that's the equivalent of winning the lottery. So the Gemara tells us that if that happens to you, you should give a certain amount of the money to charity. Why? Because if not, people are going to look at you with the evil eye, and any money you get is going to just disappear. So you want to make sure it stays there somehow or another, doing good deeds with it works. So you have all of these statements, you know, which are, I would say, largely quasi-agadic, right? There's nothing here that's really solid there, but there is a fair amount of discussion as to this concept of the evil eye. Interesting, the Gemara even goes a step beyond that. The Talmud, at some point, I've been holding a chair for you here, literally.
I'll sit here.
All right. See where I keep an eye on you, Brooks.
Good job.
So the Talmud talks about the following case. The Talmud talks about, let's say you have two neighbors, and as they're good neighbors, they have good fences, right? Good fences make good neighbors. And we both live in a ranch house, and we have a fence that's about the size of our house. And then I decide I'm moving on up, I'm going to build myself a second floor. So the Talmud says that the neighbor can force the builder to extend the fence, to make it higher. Why? Because he has certain privacy rights. I like to sit Shabbos afternoon in my underwear and read the newspaper. I don't want people watching me. So therefore, as long as we both had ranch houses that was covered, now you're going to build up. I have a right to maintain my privacy. And therefore, you have to raise the fence. That's the law. If you want to go there, I am entitled to privacy. Therefore, you want to build, that's fine. But not at my expense. The question comes up, what if you have a house, we have a fence, but I don't have a house on the other side of the fence, I have a field. Grow corn, lots of corn. And therefore, you know, you can't see that. Now you want to build a second floor. Do I have a right to claim privacy and make you raise the fence if I don't live there? So the Talmud tells us, yes, in that case as well. Why? Because I could say, I don't want you watching me. No, collecting my corn. What do you have to know how well I'm doing? I don't need you reading my books. You don't got to go peeking in my bank statement, right? I'm going to collect my corn. That will be a sign of how profitable I am this year. I don't want the ayin hara. So since I don't want the ayin hara, I don't want you looking at me. Therefore, I have a right to go to court and make you raise the fence over it. This is very interesting. This isn't, some agadic tale. This is something that's enforceable in court. This is the law, that I have a right to claim this, and it will be enforced. So you see here that there seems to be some real support for this idea that there is something called the eye in horror, the evil eye, that should be avoided. So the question comes up, how do you get here? What is it? Right. Why in the world would God want this? So there are different approaches. The first approach is a little bit like this. The first approach says that in life, we all do good things, we all do bad things. And at some point in life, we get rewarded for the good, and we get punished for the bad. That's pretty basic. However, there is no instant punishment for our sins. In fact, the fact that God allows us to repent, to do tshuva, means he's got to give us some time. If we did the sin and then we got punished right away, well, there wouldn't be any room for repentance. So at all times, on our personal books, we have a certain amount of sins sitting there that hopefully over time we will repent and get rid of. And if not, it will, the debt will be collected eventually. But at any time, if anyone would go up to heaven and look at any of our books would always have a certain amount of sins sitting on it. So the first approach is the approach of the Aruch Chaim, who today says Yahrzeit according to Asaf and Shul, says as follows, that you go and you, I have a good life. I have a nice house, I have a nice car, I have lovely children. Now I'm living a blessed life. And somebody sees me and they're jealous. You know, this person, they have financial difficulties, they have familial difficulties. And they say, why is he, why is she having such a good life while I, you know, I'm struggling to get by? I don't think the person is that much greater than me. I don't think that they're any great righteous person. You know, they're an average type of person. I'm an average type of person. Their life is great. My life stinks. That's not fair, God. So what's God's reaction at this point? Upon hearing that, God says, well, let's check the books. Inevitably, when God checks the books, we will all be found wanting. Therefore, once an audit has been made by your neighbor, shall we say, right, your neighbor has stepped in there and says, you know, there's something fishy here, I want to recount. Inevitably, you will be found wanting, and therefore, you will not have what you had beforehand. So the first approach to it is that the evil eye is sort of an audit. No one ever wants an audit. This is no exception to the rule, that God is going to look and say, in fact, people have noticed you are very blessed, that they think you don't deserve it, and upon looking over, they tend to have a good point. So that's the first approach. The first approach to the evil eye, it's a matter of that God looks over and says, in fact, there's a point here. Yes.
With the same concept with Lashon Hara. So everything's quiet, and then the little voices, and you know, ears perk up, and then you had a heavenly court kind of thing. And they check out your good stuff with the person.
Right, right. You know, there's 2-3 prakim before this week's Haftarah is the famous story of Eliyahu goes to, actually, this was later on, Elisha. Goes to this woman on a regular basis, and whenever he passes through town, she has made for him a little room where he stays, etc. And at some point he says, you know, listen, you know, you've been so kind to us, you've shown such great hospitality. Is there anything we can do for you? You know, I'm a Navi, I'm a major player. Can I perhaps talk to the government on your behalf? You know, is there anything I can do? And the woman says, no, besoch ami enochi yoshemes. No, I don't want the king to know who I am. I don't want anything. I want to be a regular person. And the idea being, because who needs it, right? The best way to go through life is lay low. Lay low, you know, nobody notices. It says in Koheles that, you know, there's an invasion of a city and the people are killed. And there's one old man who no one ever noticed beforehand. No one notices him now, and he gets out alive. Right? There's one to be said for keeping a low profile. Right, so people, that's the best way to go. And so to here, if I am living a certain type of life, and suddenly I've raised my profile, and people are going to say, yes.
But Hashem doesn't need someone to remind him to look at our books.
No, not at all. But the Chumash does seem to say that if reminded, he does look. Right, it's because when we talk about the orphan and the widow, it says take care of them, because if not, they will cry out to me, you know, and I will listen to them. The implication being, I am listening because they are crying out. And God, on his own, is willing to give us a little slack. But if someone turns around and says, hey, this isn't fair, so, yes?
But is there any, accountability on the part of the person who's looking?
That's a good question.
You know, that, you know, so who, well, I'm not a perfect person, I'm looking at them and I'm jealous. You know, how does that reflect on me as far as...
Right, nobody wants someone to be punished on their behalf, right?
Right.
Right. So yeah, there definitely is what to be said of that. Everyone should be happy with what they have, but you know, some things are a natural reaction.
Right, I know, but does it prompt Hashem to check us too? I mean, if we're
no,
if
because
we're
again,
prompting this audit
just,
of somebody
again,
else.
Again, we're not saying that it's the best thing to do, but nobody has requested an audit on us. So maybe we're the ones
I see.
My question was similar. Who really suffers from the evil eye? It seems to me that the person who is jealous you know, is committing is certainly a bigger avera than the person he's jealous of.
Right. No,
he,
so that's,
he's coveting this person's property.
So that's a good point. So let me try to rephrase it. The idea is the person who's coveting is doing the sin, but the person who's being coveted is suffering. That's not dissimilar that if I would shoot you, I would be doing a sin, but you would be the one who would be suffering.
But I wouldn't have to go through an audit. I bet you went on. I take the bullet.
Okay. Right. So you know, so that's approach number one. Let's go for approach number two. So approach number two is based on the Maharsha. It goes a little bit like this. So there is a concept in Judaism, more or less, of blessing. Right? We have Birchat Kohanim. That the Kohanim get up in Israel every day, here, not as much, and they give us a blessing, and somehow that's supposed to help us. And there are people who believe in more that you know that great holy people can give blessings, Kabbalists can give blessings, Rebbes can give blessings. Right? There's a lot of people making a good living off of this. Right? There's this concept of blessings out there. So the concept of blessings are very difficult to understand. Right? I'm a simple person. Right? I believe in reward and punishment. And in the event the person is ultimately a good person, ultimately they will be rewarded for it. Not right away, right? I'm not going to see an instantaneous, you know, correlation, but in the long term, the people who do good will be rewarded. And the people who unfortunately do not do good, unfortunately they'll end up on the other side of the stick. That's the basics of it. Given that, so if you bless me from today till tomorrow, why should that make a difference? What's this concept of blessing? If I'm a good person, I don't need your blessing. If I'm a bad person, it shouldn't help. What, I should be able to sit in and then go out and get a blessing and we're all better? So there's a question, how do blessings work? And it's interesting. If you look at the, back in Parshas Nasa, we talk about the Birchat Kohanim. At the very end, it says, Kosavarch les b'nei Israel, that there is a commandment, Aaron, you're supposed to bless the people of Israel, and this is what it's supposed to say, and it says the verses, Yerecha v'mishmerecha, etc., etc. Then there's a very last pasuk, right before the end of the Leah, there's one more pasuk. It says, V'samu shmi al b'nei Yisrael v'ani avarechem. And you shall put your name on the people of Israel, and I will bless them. So to quote Daffy Duck, there's problems with your prepositions here. Who is the I will bless them? Who is the them who will get blessed? So Rashi says there's two approaches. One approach is as follows. The Kohanim bless the Jews that are all there. Right? The Yisraelim, the Levim, everybody's not there. And they say, and what is it? And we say, Yivarechecha Hashem Yishmerecha. God should bless you and protect you. So what we're saying is, you, the Kohanim, are going to make a request. The blessing is a request. God, please do this. And when you make the request, I'll listen to you. That's approach number one. That the last pasuk means that whenever you say the Kohanim, saying the Birchat Kohanim, it will be accepted. Approach number two is different. Approach number two says, no. When the Kohanim bless the Yisraelim, etc., that works automatically. The issue here is the Kohanim say, well, this is great. You know, I'm a Kohen, I got all this work to do, and I'm the only person who never gets blessed. Because I'm never sitting in the crowd. I'm always here. Go put up a big mirror, and how is this going to work for me? So therefore, God says, no. You bless the crowd, and I will bless the Kohanim. So that's the question. So those are the two approaches. Now, those two approaches speak to potentially two approaches of what a blessing is. Approach number one is blessing is a prayer. Right? You know, I am requesting God, please help this person. And God will decide yes or no. The second approach is no. That there's something called the koach habracha, the power to bless. And there are people out there who have this power, and they have the ability to bless whether or not God's interested in it. And that happens to fit in nicely with the Chumash in general, right? If you go back all the way to Parshas Lech Lecha, God turns to Avram and says, Mivarechcha Baruch, Makalelcha Aor. You can bless whoever you want, you can curse whoever you want. That's going to work. And in fact, this power to bless is given over to Yitzhak, his son. Yitzhak has that power, the brachas, that he's going to give over. He means to give it to Esav, he actually gives it over to Yaakov. So there's something out there. There is a power that people have. Some people have this power.
And cursing.
What?
And cursing.
Right. So just like, however you're going to work out, there is this power of a person to bless. You're going to have to accept the flip side is that there's a power to curse. Just like Bilam, right? To refer to the eye of Bilam. Right? So what this is saying is there's something out there called the Koach HaBracha, and the flip side is the Ayin Hara. That if I turn to you and I bless you that you should have a long life and happiness, that means something. And similarly, if I wish you the opposite, unfortunately that means something as well. So that's the second approach. The second approach is there is some power out there, and you don't want to mess with it. Yes?
Question on that. Is the Ayin Hara neutral, or is it a curse, or is it neutral? So if you covet, okay, fine. Mm. But it doesn't mean you curse the other person.
Right, but you're jealous.
Okay.
It means if you're jealous. You're jealous means, jealousy means, how come they have it and I don't?
But it doesn't mean you don't want them to have it. It means you want to have it.
This is the old blind me in one eye and give my neighbor double.
One of my children had still has this in her somewhat, saying her didn't give away anything. And at one time I said to her, would you like to get a lollipop and everyone gets two lollipops or nobody gets anything? And in a second she said, nobody should get anything because it's not fair. I said, how about you get two and they all get one? That would be okay. So yeah, the concept of fairness is somewhat fungible, shall we say.
Yes.
Right? But that's the idea. Jealousy means that if I don't have it, I don't want you to have it. Right? And that's also comes to that. Yes?
Where does the bendel and all that come
from? Oh, we're way short of the bendel. We'll get to the bendel. Yes?
But what you're saying is the evil eye is more than just the audit. You're saying that there's a power.
Right, this is different. This is different
this
than the
is
first
a different
opinion.
Approach.
Right. This
okay.
is the second approach. Right. This is the second approach. And now the third approach. The third approach is a fascinating approach. It says as follows. So if you remember, again, we'll go back to Bereishis once again. Avram and Sarah, they don't have children. So therefore they decide, okay, here's what we're going to do. Avram's going to marry Hagar. And Hagar has a child, and afterwards Sarah has a child. Now Avram has two children. One's named Yishmael, one's named Yitzhak. Okay, now we got these two children, and they're not getting along at all. Right, so therefore Sarah says, you're going to have to throw out Yishmael. And Avram checks in with God. God gives him the go-ahead. He gets sent on his merry way. And in fact, he gets very sick. And it comes to the point that he's dying of thirst. And Hagar can't take it anymore. She walks away. And an angel comes and he's saved. That's the story in the Chumash. The Gemara tells us at one point that up until the point of Yaakov Avinu, no one ever got sick. People just died. There was no sickness. Yeah, you lived, and then you died. There was no in-between.
So introducing something new to the world.
What? And in fact, Yaakov himself prayed for it. He wanted to be sick. He wanted to know. He wanted some warning when the end was near. Right, so that was Yaakov Avinu, that he was the first one who had a sickness. That he got a warning that death was imminent. It wasn't until much later in history, it says, in the time of Elisha, perhaps, or Chizkiah, that someone that got sick and actually got better from it. Right? Sickness at that point in history was just a matter of a warning. You're going to die, and here, you know, so get your papers in order. Put your house in order. So the Mizrahi, the Perush and Rashi says, I don't understand. You're telling me that up until Yaakov, no one got sick. And you're telling me that up until Chizkiah, Elisha, no one ever got better. But years before any of these people, Yishmael gets sick, and Yishmael gets better.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened to that? What's he, Chaplinger? What we have here, the Chumash, this isn't some Baba Meisa, this is a story of the Chumash. That Yishmael was sick, he was about to die, then he goes on to live a long, productive life afterwards. So how do you deal with that? So he says as follows. He says there was no concept of sickness, there's no disease beforehand. However, even before Yaakov, if someone punched you in the nose, it hurt. And if someone broke your arm, it would be broken, and it could get better afterwards. What was introduced at the time of Yaakov Avinu was disease. That being said, he said, what happened to Yishmael? How did Yishmael get sick? So Rashi tells us that Sarah gave him an ayin hara. So he says, an ayin hara, you know what an ayin hara is? It's like getting punched in the nose. It's a physical act. Scientifically, when you stare at somebody in a certain way, it scientifically, physically hurts the person. That is the opinion of the Chizkuni, that there is something to it. And many people followed him afterwards in this idea. For example, the Abarbanel was clearly a man of the world. Don Yitzhak Abarbanel was a major player in the Spanish court. He was of the opinion, absolutely, there's something to it. It's very interesting. There's a book, I'm sure some people heard of, the Torah Tamima. It's written by a fellow named Epstein, lived in the beginning of the 20th century, not so long ago. He wrote other svarim as well. One was called the Tosefes Bracha. And the Tosefes Bracha, on Parshas Balak, he says, you know, I know that most people don't believe this is true. I know that there are a lot of opinions out there. He says, it's scientific proof. What's the scientific proof? He said, in the year 1881, the Russian Academy of Sciences went to the Russian Bureau of Prisons, whatever the equivalent was, and said, the enemy you're going to kill anyhow, would like to borrow him. Things were different back then. They said, sure, fine. They took a guy who was condemned to death. They put him in a cell and they starved him for 3 days. And for those 3 days, they kept a loaf of bread just out of his reach, and they had him stare at it all day. At the end of the 3 days, they cut the loaf of bread in half, and they found it to be full of poison. They said, that conclusively proves that there's something called the evil eye. In fact, he looked at this wantingly for 3 days, and now you see that it turned into poison. That proves it. So I actually read this first on an LL airplane. I was reading a book, and I said, no. Nah, come on. So I said, you know what? I'm a believer that if this is true, if there was such a Russian newspaper article, you can find it on the internet. Right?
Yeah.
Someone once said to me a very deep thought. He said, there's no such thing as cow tipping. How does he know that cow tipping is not true? Because if it was true, there'd be a YouTube video. Right? The fact that there is no YouTube video cow tipping means that there is no such thing as cow tipping. Think about that. So, on that excellent piece of logic, if this article exists, it's got to be on the internet. Sorry. Plane landed. The next night, the next morning, I had some sort of jet lag, so I was up at 5 in the morning. I said, I'm going online. I'm going to find this thing if it's out there. And I looked and I looked and I looked, and I found it. So in 1937, a doctor named Benjamin Gordon wrote an article in the Archives of Ophthalmology on the topic of ayin hara. Can you believe it? Ophthalmology, ayin hara again.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it's out, and you know, and I used my academic privileges at yeshiva to get myself an inter-office day, a copy of it. And I can email you a PDF of it. They have it. And in the article, he quotes this. He said there was this article in 1881. And he says, and he has good reason to not trust it. And there are a few things that don't really smell right. One is, assuming that the Russian Academy of Arts and Sciences would do a study, you'd expect to find it published in a scholarly journal, not the Denver Post. And the fact that it was in a popular newspaper already begins to undermine the veracity of it. The second thing is, he said, think about it. Damp Russian prison. You leave bread there for 3 days. Even if nobody is staring at it, it's going to turn a little bit rancid. So he thinks that it wasn't much of a proof.
It's going to be gone from the mice.
What?
The mice will eat it.
I guess. They're protecting us.
hang it.
He remembers. He was there.
Also, there are probably enough Russian prisoners condemned to death that they could have done some controls.
So the the Torah Timur did not make up the article. The article clearly was there. He got the same newspaper, etc. Exactly page number. He got it all right. Right, and there is this belief out there that this is for real, this is serious. It's very interesting. So I happened to be looking this morning. I wanted to take a look at this Tosafot Brachot, so I did a Google search, and it seemed that there's an Israeli website, Ynet. Anyone familiar with it? So Ynet had this thing published on it, and a guy responded saying, you know, this is the Torah Tumima. The Torah Tumima is the same guy who wrote that he believes in turning copper into gold. This guy. So I said, no, I got to search this. Found it. Son of a gun. There's a lot to be said about the Jewish approach to alchemy. Maybe next year. Make a note of that. So you have some very strong beliefs. Now, it's interesting that this approach, which I think might be the majority approach. Now, if you look at these things, the fact that there is something to it, and again, my gut feeling is not that way. However, it's very hard to scientifically prove a negative. Mm-hmm. Right? It's very difficult to prove that there's no such thing as spontaneous reproduction. Can't really prove that easily. You can prove that this is not that. But to prove that the whole thing doesn't exist is very difficult. To prove that there is no such thing as an eye and heart is very difficult to prove, so I'm not going to say it's not true. Mm-hmm. But, you know, current scientific thought definitely does not point in that direction. We can say that. But this leads to a lot of interesting thoughts. So, for example, we have discussed every week until now the opinion of the Rambam. Whether it's Gilgulim, whether it's Shane, whatever it is, we always get up and we say, these people support it, these people support it, these people support it, and then there's the Rambam. Right? The Rambam is a rationalist, he denies. And there's the Rambam, then there's the Rambam. So you would expect, once again, for us to be saying, and then there's the Rambam. So let's discuss the Rambam. There is a Gemara in Bava Metzia which says as follows: if someone finds a lost object, you have to take care of the lost object, mm-hmm. right? And so, if it's something, if it's a book that needs to be aired out, you air it out. If it's an animal, you have to feed it. You know, they have specific rules. So, what if you find a piece of cloth? So, the Gemara tells us that you're supposed to hang the cloth out, you know, so there. However, if you have guests over, you put it away. So, someone says, why do you put it away when guests come? One of two possibilities. Imishud Gandhi, what is your word is going to get stolen. People are going to see it, they're going to like it, they're going to steal it. Imishim Eina, or because of Ayin Hara. So, when the Rif, bring this down, La Halacha, when they codify the law, they say it exactly like that. That you have to hang it out unless you have guests over. And when you have guests over, you put it away, either because you're worried it's going to get stolen, or perhaps because you're worried that it's going to get an ayin hara. The Rambam codifies it and says you have to hang it up, and in the event that guests come over, you have to put it away because perhaps it'll get stolen. So a lot of people say, there goes the Rambam again. The Rambam denies it. Remember we discussed earlier on the idea of the privacy fence, right? The Rambam leaves out the part of that if there's a field on the other side, you have to raise it as well. So the assumption a lot of people write is that the Rambam denies it. However, there's one very important person who does not agree with that, and that is the Rambam himself. The Rambam, in his responsa, in his tshuvas, writes that, in fact, there is such a thing. He does believe in it. That, in fact, that person should try to avoid the ayin hara. A lot of people explain, or Moshe Feinstein says, he says, because everything else, when you're talking about demons, when you're talking about reincarnation, that's something supernatural. But this, the Rambam can't deny it, it's natural. It's a very interesting approach that people take it quite seriously, this idea of the Ayin Hara, that, you know, that even the Rambam himself, who denies everything else, all of a sudden is accepting of this. There are other interesting examples as well. What about if you have a case of something might be an ayin hara? So, do you have to be careful for even the maybe ayin haras? Or enough. If it's an ayin hara, you don't do it. But if it's a maybe ayin hara, you don't worry about it so much. So Rav Vadir Yosef writes that there's a kanta called chamira sakanta meyisura. What that means is as follows. Let's say I have 100 salamis, no wrapping on them. 99 of them are kosher, and one of them isn't. Am I allowed to eat the salamis? Yes, I am allowed to. Let's have 100 salamis. 99 of them are fine, and one of them is poisonous. Mm. Halachically, are you allowed to eat the salami? No, you cannot. Why not? Chamira sakata meyisura. When it comes to sakana, when it comes to danger, we care more about danger. We care more about keeping people healthy than we care about, you know, the halacha. The halacha, you can play the odds and hope that you're getting it right. When it comes to danger, we don't play the odds, right? We do. So he says, so too here. This is a matter of, if it's usually, you know, a suffix you're not sure, maybe you can risk it, but here, it's danger. This is real danger, Ayin Hara, therefore, when in doubt, you should not get yourself involved in it. Another interesting case.
How do you not get yourself involved? It seems like
the
Ayin Hara is the eye of the beholder. You know,
right,
you have no control if somebody is covetous of you. Or just
that's not totally true.
I
could drive a Chevy and I could drive a DeLorean.
Yeah. Or you, but if you drive the DeLorean and you give a lot of your time and money to tzedakah, people won't be envious of you. So there is a way to have
right. wealth. Or you cannot drive the DeLorean.
But I'm saying, but people have wealth that other people don't begrudge them.
Right. You know, there are people out there who say, he deserves it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he deserves it. Right? Yeah, if there was a guy that deserves it, it's him, you know?
you deserve it.
I don't know why you haven't gotten it yet, you know?
It also made you sick.
Yeah.
So you get back to what you were saying before with the Rambam. It begs a deeper question: and why would, if he believes in Ayin Hara, why would he leave all the other?
Because there
are plenty of responses from the Rambam that have been forged.
Right. No. So again, there are good reasons to believe that. For example, the Rambam traditionally, if there are two answers given, people point out he usually only gives one of the two. Uh-huh. Usually, just gives the first one. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, some people say so. That's why he just went with one. Then what? Why bother giving the second? You know, do it because it might get stolen. Right? You don't gain anything by it. So you know. So there are other ways. It's a good question, but it's dealt with. So you know, there are these people. There are ways of just laying low. You know, there are people who've got tons of money and you never know, and the people who've got tons of money and you absolutely know it. So there is. And, you know, it's worth noting, you know, I was going to note it at the end, but I'll note it right now. Whether you believe it or not, there's something to be said about living a simple life. Right? To acting in a way that people don't begrudge you. Whether you believe in Ayin Hara or not, there is definitely value to that. Right? So that's, you know, in terms of the practical ramifications, that's an important note.
You don't necessarily have to believe those two are mutually exclusive.
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, again, according to the first approach, that you know that there's something involved that I'm doing wrong, and that's why it's working. You know, it could be the what I'm doing wrong. Again, if anybody who knows anything about Jewish history knows that when Jews start showing off their wealth, whatever country they happen to be in, it doesn't turn out too good. In fact, you know that from Yaakov. If you remember, when there's a famine in Canaan, so Yaakov tells his sons, go down to Egypt and get food. Lama tisro, he uses the words. So this is a difficult living in Lama Tisro. So Rashi says, they had food at the time. Like they were doing fine. But they didn't need the people to see that they're all starving. The Jews have, Yaakov and his sons have food. So he said, you get online also, and you also get food. Right? There's no reason that everybody has to see, you know, that we're doing much better. It's not going to turn out in a good way. So in terms of practical ramifications of this, so where does it come up, the idea of Ayin Hara, what do we do about it? So halachically, there are two cases quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. One is we don't give a father and a son aliyahs in a row, right? We do not do it. Even if you clap beforehand, still it's not allowed. Unless we think that in real shuls they clap first and then it's okay. That's not how it works. That's one approach, right? The second thing that they point out is this idea of someone whose parents are alive does not say Kaddish, right? Or no, very similar to it, if someone's blessed, if your parents are still alive, when you do Yisker, you walk out. So, keeping these in mind, there's an interesting question related to this once again, is the Gemara in Pesachim talks about the idea of Shadim. And it says when it comes to Shadim, if you don't bother them, they won't bother you. Right? That meaning that if you don't believe in them, they're basically not there. It's like the neighborhood bully, right? Your mother always told you if you don't let him know that it's bothering you, he'll stop. Right? So the same thing works for Shadim, it seems. That if I believe in Shadim, so I'm gonna have trouble with them. If I don't believe in them, then I won't have trouble. The question is, does the same thing apply for the Ayin Hara? I'm not scared for the Ayin Hara. Can you say something like that? It's interesting. I was once in the this past winter, I think it was. I was in the basin. It was like 4:30. It was time for mincha already. So we pulled together a minyan. So there's a fellow there who's a sofer. He writes the Gittin. And he lives in Williamsburg. He's a Satra Chassid. We said to him, no, we're going to daven mincha. You want to daven with us? So he said, I'm going to go home. I'll daven there. He said, the shkia, sunset's in 15 minutes. You're going to Williamsburg. I said, I'm not scared of the shkia. That was it. I'm not scared of the shkia. So something. I'm not scared of the Ayin Hara. Can you say that? I'm not scared of the Ayin Hara. Ayin Hara, it's... people get nervous. The people with those high five hands, they get nervous at the Ayin Hara. But me, I don't care about it. So Moshe Feinstein says, yeah. Moshe Feinstein says the same idea. If you believe in the Ayin Hara, then you got to deal with the Ayin Hara. If you don't believe in the Ayin Hara, that's it. It's not there anymore. Most people, top to bottom, disagree with him based on this concept that, you know, if it's real, if you know, this is a form of damage, you can't. You know, I'm walking in traffic, saying, you hit by a car. I don't believe in getting hit by cars. That's not going to work. That's not a long-term plan. Not much of a short-term plan. Right? So the question is, whether you can deny it. So there does seem to be some support for it. So, for example, Calvin's life with Baal Tshuva's. Right? Baal Tshuva loses a grandparent. Okay? Now, the Baal Tshuva's parents are not religious. The father's not a shul goer. And therefore, the father's not going to be saying Kaddish. But the son, you know, goes to shul every day and volunteers. I'll say Kaddish for Bubby. So what's the rule? But the grandson has living parents. So not an uncommon question. Can the grandson say the Kaddish for the grandparent in a situation where no one else is going to say it? Even though the parents are still alive. So the Ramah, the Shulchan Aruch, tells us, if the parents don't mind, they're allowed to do it. So what does that sound like?
It sounds like ignoring the... It
sounds very much like where Moshe Feinstein said, if you leave it alone, it'll go away. If you can just ignore it, and that's it, not a problem.
As long as it's okay with everyone else.
What?
As long as it's okay with everyone else.
Well, again, it's only... The person would be the parents. If the parents the parents are the ones that are potentially in trouble.
Right.
If they say it doesn't bother them, so you can go ahead with it.
But how can you do that if you say, well, I don't believe in it, but you don't have the consent of everyone else?
Well, what do you mean, everyone else?
Everyone else in the world is giving you...
The idea is that the eye of the eye is not going to affect me if I don't believe in it.
And if the parents
basically, you're taking the halachic approach of sticks and stones may break my bones, mm-hmm. but evil eyes will never harm me. Right? That the other doesn't. So this does sound a little bit to be supporting the idea that if you don't believe in it, in this case the parent not believing in it, then it basically ceases to exist. The truth of the matter is that's probably not so true. Because there's a difference. We keep on referring to the evil eye. What's the evil eye? The evil eye is the case where I am begrudging you something. This is not the case. Nobody's begrudging me. I'm not begrudging you that you're saying Kaddish. This is a different thing. This is what's called Al Tifta Pelasata. Don't give the Satan any ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So here in this case, someone's going to see a guy saying kasha, did he lose his mother, did he lose his father, what happened?
Mm.
Right? And just saying those words perhaps could have a negative effect. And if the parents are saying that I don't care about that, that's different than the idea of ayin hara. Right, so compare that to the case, the other case we gave, of the two, of the father and the son getting consecutive aliyahs. So, what's the reason for that? That's a real ayin hara. Oh, look at this. Look at this family. Right, oh, the Moshe Greis. Right, they get all the aliyahs, they get everything. So the Shulchan Aruch, the commentary is talking about, what if a guy says, listen, I'm having a bar mitzvah, I got to get an aliyah, my son's got to get an aliyah, my father's got to get my father-in-law, my brother, my uncle, I need a lot of aliyahs. And it's not going to work out unless we do some of them in order. So the Gadbai says, can't do that. Why not? Ayin hara. The guy says, I don't care about the ayin hara. You keep your ayin hara and give me my aliyahs. So we say you're not allowed to do that. Even if you say, I don't care, right? Even in that case, still you can't take the two in a row. So that was indeed pointing the other way. Yes?
Where do you come in that it's a custom, like the Ashkenazi and Sephardim? Like they name the child after the living? We don't. There's just a lot of things like that, but he changed the name of a very sick person.
Right, so
is that a custom or a belief? Or where? Where do you go?
So again, let's take one at a time. The first thing you spoke about is this idea of naming. Ashkenazim do not name after a living person because of ayin hara. That's a self-perpetuating type of thing. Because we only name after dead people, therefore, if you would name it after someone, you would assume the person is dead. Sephardim, who name after living people, the fact that you name it after someone does not make anyone presume that the person is anything but living. Right? So that's an interesting case in terms of not a matter of whether you're accepting ayin hara or not, it's just a matter of the tradition leads itself to be either problematic or not, depending on what it is. The other things like, you know, changing the name of a sick person, though some people have such a tradition, it's not related to ayin hara. It's an idea of that, you know, there is a decree against Yaakov ben Shlomo. So therefore, Yaakov ben Shlomo says, well, we think that, if we change the name to Yaakov Raphael ben Shlomo, right, then the Malach HaMelech won't be able to find him. Change of address, no forwarding address, sorry, goodbye. And that's a very different approach. It's not necessarily the same thing. You had mentioned earlier the idea of the bendel. Poo, poo, poo. Right? So the bendel is, for those who don't know, the red string that some people wear to ward off ayin hara. Similarly, some people have what's called the chamsa.
Yep.
Right? High five sign, right? Same idea. Just a few points. What is the Chamsa is not Jewish. It's Arabic. It's something that we picked up in the Arabic nations. We did not do it. They did it. We have absolutely no reason to believe that it's worth anything. So
it's pretty. It's pretty.
Right. It's pretty. That might be nice. You know? Right? Interesting.
Kabbalistic? Is that some Kabbalistic something else?
I don't hold myself out to be a great Kabbalist, but as far as I know, it is not.
That's very interesting because we spend a lot of time in Florida.
Uh-huh.
And half of the community.
I can't wait to see how this ties in.
They're very strong Sephardic, so one of my friends came in and said, you can't have this open, you don't have a chamsa. So,
I
brought one.
So
I put it in the house.
I have two chamsa stories. We're getting a little late, so I'll tell them quickly. The first chamsa story I have is follows that in the 9/11 at some point there was a need to someone who had passed away in the World Trade Center. They had to DNA match the person, and I got a call from the office of the chief medical examiner of New York and said, can you come down, we have an issue that maybe you could help us out with. They showed they had DNA of this person, which matched the DNA matches the father and the mother. However, a friend of the family gave in something, and they got a DNA sample from that, and it does not match the thing that they gave in. So they wanted to know, you know, what is this thing? So they were about, they said, we're going to announce that we found that this body part is this person based on the kinship analysis of the parents, but they wanted to know what exactly is this other thing that we have. They said this other thing clearly was not his. So it was some sort of chamsa. It was a Sephardi person. So you can look at that in one of two ways. One is it didn't help him much. The other one is he gave away to his friend, and that's why it ended.
Oh.
Someone else came over to me and said that they're real Ashkenazim, very strong. And this guy said, this woman, I said, my mother-in-law keeps on bringing chamsas for the kids. And whenever she brings it, when she leaves, we throw them out. And one time she came and she brought a charm bracelet with a chamsa on it. And it was really hard to get off. So I figured, okay, you know, we'll just wait a day and after, and then, you know, we'll get something to take it off. So that night, we got into a car accident. So, of course, you can read this any way that makes you happy. You can read it that, oh, thank God it was still on, or else there would have been a worse car accident. Oh, no, the fact that it was still there, they didn't get rid of it, that caused the car accident, you know. So, you know.
Okay, I have another one.
Yeah.
When something strikes your home, and people say it's bad, they say you better check your mezuzahs.
Uh-huh.
What is that?
That's not even lying.
Right.
It is
so,
superstition.
Right.
Yes.
So again, it's, who is it? Dan Wolf from Eidos came out to me one time and said, oh, my kids, they're going off the coal, and I don't know what it is. I said, you better check the mezuzahs.
Well, that's the first thing we did. My grandson had the leukemia. We went home and...
And what happened?
We got all new, this is the parchments. We got all new ones. We didn't have any time to talk to anybody.
What do you do with the old ones? Can I still get them? Right. So again, I heard is not the catch-all for all superstition, right? You know, so it's important to have kosher mezuzahs in your house. I think we all agree on that, and it's important to do mitzvahs. And doing mitzvahs, you know.
Well, I had all kosher ones, but if something's wrong with them, they said that's.
Yeah.
If there's a letter missing,
then it's not kosher.
Well, that's not kosher then.
Right.
Right. So again, if they're kosher, they're kosher. If not, they should be changed.
But I think another thing that's terrible, because my family went through this. I lost a brother of 17 overnight. And I think of this family that lost that child in Brooklyn. They're blaming themselves. What did he do wrong?
Right. So could be, again, none of us should have the gall to say that we know why God does
things.
And
I had people in my home that asked my parents, what did you do wrong? I mean, I asked them to leave. I was only 8, and I asked them to leave.
That was very generous of you just to ask.
I just wanted you to clarify the point about the grandson saying Kaddish, because you said it wasn't an evil eye issue, it was that you were sort of calling the Satan.
Right.
So wouldn't that be good enough not to do it?
Right, no, but yes, you could say about that if you're not nervous about that, it doesn't affect you.
You mean if you're not nervous about the Satan?
Right, the parents
saying,
right. And that was the point. So okay, we'll just end up here. We'll just end with the red bendel.
Oh, yes.
So the red bendel happens to be mentioned in the Talmud. The Tosefta in the 11th parak of Shabbos has a list of all the things that you're not allowed to do because they're rooted in what's called Darkei Emori, the ways of the non-Jews. The entire list, none of it exists anymore except for the red bendel. The red bendel specifically says you're not allowed to do it. Now, I understand I'm arguing with major sources here, like Madonna, for example. The lady at the Kotel, you know.
Yeah, right.
Don't want to mess with her.
I know.
The Kevin Ruffel lady. You know, there are a lot of very important people out there, but I'm not a fan at all, and I think at best it's neutral, and it might not be best. So.
What happened to the rest of the list?
What?
You said only the...
Well, again, they used to paint, they used to do something to, they used to paint trees a certain color, and there's a long list of other things.
You mean they're not relevant?
Right,
anymore.
They've just fallen out of use. Somehow this one has remained popular, or has made a comeback. I don't know, someone's going to have to take a look at it. But the bottom line is there's a lot to be said about this, you know. There are definitely many parts of the Jewish community nowadays that strongly believe in it. Right, you know, I think in the modern Orthodox circles, not as much. But one way or the other, it all comes down to what we said earlier, that a person should live their lives in a humble way. You know, it's smart. It's a positive character trait for a person to have. And, you know, you don't want people to be jealous of you. You know, you want people to be happy for you and to share in your simchas and not think any otherwise. So I think one way or the other, believe it or not, the practical ramifications will end up being the same. Any questions?
I think it's funny how some of these old superstitions came down the line. I mean,
right,
I'm
sure there's a
piece. When my mother used to sew, she would sew a button on me. I had to chew on thread. And all of my friends in Florida that are my age, they all grew up with that. We're all different places.
Yeah, so...
What is with the tentative, though?
Right, so again, so this is the idea of the evil eye really transcends Judaism, right? If you ever study it, this was universal, and it remains universal. There are many cultures much more than us that support this, mm-hmm. and the idea being that somehow or another, for example, Israelis sometimes will name their baby Kushi. Have you ever heard the name Kushi?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean?
Black.
Right.
Kushi?
Black, meaning not good looking, right? Like specifically, people will go out of their way, two. It's like if you say something nice, you have to spit also to undo it. So that's where the 222 comes from, right? As a by the way, those of you not familiar, Kinayin Hara is really Kain Ayin Hara.
Right.
There should be no evil eye. As you say, they always say that it's a beautiful child, Kainayin Hara. I'm not jealous. Some lovely children you have. Oh, this is a lovely house. Poo, poo, poo. That's the idea behind it. Okay, so we have to make our way to Mincha. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.